prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Thursday's edition of Financial Survival, sponsored by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm your host, Dave Allen. Melody's taking care of other client business today. For all your gold and silver needs, call her toll-free at 1-800-375-4188. In the next hour, I'll be bringing you some opinions and commentary on the economic and political news of the day, Thursday, January 18, 2024. Happy National Know Your Customers Day, ladies and gentlemen. Special shout out to all of ours, whose loyal ongoing business is responsible for, well, supporting our educational efforts to bring you our daily financial survival program and our free weekly newsletter and blog. So thanks to each and every single one of you, as always, for all your physical precious metal needs. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading. Again, 1-800-375-4188. Excuse me. Let's get to today's market report. Boy, after a sluggish early morning trading, all the precious metals, had a fairly good day today, largely up on increased safe haven demand because of the rising tensions in the Middle East. Gold up nearly 17 bucks to 2023, roughly. Silver up about 0.8%, 18 cents, 22.81. Platinum up close to 3% at $917, and palladium up 24 bucks at $966. Now, still, with all of you'd think the dollar index would have gone south. While it did bob today, it's fairly flat. I mean, it's up 0.01 at 103.46, but still on an upward trend the last few weeks. Oil, which has been trending down recently, also up today on the Mideast tensions. Domestic West Texas Intermediate oil up about $1.54. a barrel today at $74.10. Natural gas still on its big slide, down another 5.75% today at $2.70 a cubic foot. In the Treasury market, yields are mixed. The 10-year yield up about 0.4 points to yield 4.14%. The 2-year yield, fairly flat. Again, it's just up ever so slightly, 0.001 point. To yield rounds to 4.36 percent. Still a very slight inversion, but that continues to narrow as the new year rolls on here. In the equities here in the States, Dow Jones up 202 points to close at 37,469. NASDAQ up another percent and a third, 200 points, 15,056. The S&P 500 up a little less than a percent, about 42 points to close at 4,781. Most of the foreign exchanges, Europeans up all but the Nikkei. Nikkei slightly down. Hong Kong and Shanghai indexes up a little bit today in Asia. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is today's DGS Coins Market Report, sponsored by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. Now, as I mentioned, Middle East tensions ratcheting up again today after the U.S. launched another round of strikes on Yemen Houthis overnight. The American military targeted 14 Houthi missiles just before midnight Yemeni time. Hours later, Pakistan got into the action, launching missiles against militants in Iran. Oil prices initially edged higher following the strikes, with international Brent rising above 578 as concerns built around the potential for interruptions to crude production and disrupted supply chains. Since the war between Israel and Hamas erupted in early October, the Houthis have attacked vessels in the Red Sea. U.S. bases have come under fire from Iran-backed groups in Iraq and Syria, and Tehran has struck targets now in neighboring countries. Iran has taken military action against what it called an Israeli intelligence operation in Iraq and launched attacks in both Pakistan and Syria. Iran-backed Houthis have also upended global shipping by attacking vessels in the Red Sea, triggering retaliatory strikes from the U.S. and Britain. Israel President Isaac Herzog says the Houthi issue is a number one priority because it raises the cost of living for every family in the universe. A little tribe of 50,000 people amassed with the weapons of an empire. Yesterday in Davos, maybe it was today, Iran's foreign minister insisted that Iran's strike in Iraq, as well as against an alleged militant base in Pakistan, are part of his country's right to self-defense, and accused Israel of genocide in its campaign against Hamas, which has killed thousands of Palestinian civilians. Iraqi Prime Minister also condemned the war in Gaza, saying the international community has failed. Now, Herzog said normalizing ties between Israel and Saudi Arabia is a key element of ending the war with Hamas and a game changer for the entire Middle East. It's still delicate, he observed. It's fragile and it'll take a long time, but I think that it's actually an opportunity to move forward in the world and the region toward a better future. Herzog's pronouncement comes days after Saudi Arabia's foreign minister, Prince Faisal bin Farhan, said on a Davos panel that the kingdom agreed that regional peace includes peace for Israel. He said Saudi Arabia certainly would recognize Israel as part of a larger political agreement, but That can only happen, he added, through peace for the Palestinians, through a Palestinian state. Well, House Speaker Mike Johnson and Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer reportedly had a bipartisan glow about them after they and other congressional leaders met with the president yesterday. They talked about Ukraine aid, southern border security, and elements of a deadlock government funding package, which you might have heard the Senate passed earlier this afternoon by a vote, I think, of 77 to 18, which now goes to a very skeptical and divided House of Representatives. Johnson told reporters, "We had a productive meeting," after the White House sit-down ended. Schumer said the meeting showed there was agreement between the D's and R's that additional aid for Ukraine and improved U.S. border security are necessary. He said the only way we will do border and Ukraine, or even either of them, is bipartisan. Anyone who says, do it my way or no way, we're not going to get anything done. That meeting was also attended by Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries, and various congressional committee chairs and ranking members. The collaborative sentiment expressed by Johnson and Schumer could, with the emphasis on could, signal hope for Biden's supplemental aid request, which would provide funding, additional funding to Ukraine, Israel, Taiwan, and the U.S. southern border. McConnell said a Senate floor vote on the supplemental package could be held next week after a months-long stalemate in Congress. But still, I guess that was held earlier today, excuse me. But the bipartisan message could be a liability for Speaker Johnson. He was recently elected Speaker with the key support of hardline House Republicans who expect him to deliver on their wish list. His predecessor, Kevin McCarthy, was ousted by that faction because of his cooperation with Democrats to pass a short-term spending measure which avoided a federal government shutdown. Well, that's what the packages that the Senate passed today that would avoid a partial shutdown for a handful or so of government agencies extend their funding into March this year. Representative Chip Roy of Texas has already warned that a motion to boot Johnson is on the table, to use his words, after the speaker announced the bipartisan deal a couple of days ago to approve a federal budget that would spend up to, well, $1.66 trillion for the current fiscal year. Well, again, meanwhile, Congress is busy trying now to get the House to pass a short-term spending resolution by midnight tomorrow to prevent that partial shutdown. Biden initially requested $105 billion supplemental package from Congress in October to aid Israel and Ukraine in their wars, along with securing Taiwan's defense systems and the U.S. southern border. In the ensuing months, the bill has remained at a stalemate, though Biden has tried several times to turn up the pressure. And that would be my loyal watchdog, Macy, saying hello to our postal carrier. Sorry about that. Congressional Republicans have demanded more funding for the southern border and less for Ukraine. And I have a feeling the eventual outcome will provide more money for both. Then both sides can say, hey, look, bases, I won, or we won. Biden has actually used up the last of his executive funding bucket for Ukraine. The last security assistance package for them was authorized in late December, and now there's no more money left unless or until Congress passes a supplemental package. In economic news, single-family home building dropped sharply in December after a string of strong gains, but new construction remains propped up by a shortage of previously owned homes for sale. Single-family housing starts, which account for the bulk of home building, fell close to 9% to a seasonally adjusted annual rate of a little over a million units last month. That's according to the Census Bureau today. Rainy weather last month likely contributed to the plunge in home building. Wonder how this month's snow will affect the next report. Single-family starts increased about 16%, though, on an annualized basis. Single-family home building fell in the Northeast, Midwest, and the densely populated South, but rose in the West. A survey from the National Association of Home Builders out yesterday showed confidence among single-family builders having improved sharply thus far this month. That occurs the rate in the 30-year fixed mortgage retreated further to around 6.7% after peaking at a 23-year high of around 8% in late October. That's according to Freddie Mac. The NAHB survey showed the share of builders reporting cutting home prices in January was the smallest in 5 months. And multifamily building permits rose 1.4% to a rate of about 449,000 units last month. Building permits as a whole increased just shy of 2% to a rate of about 1.5 million units. They dropped almost 12% in 2023. And yes, it is Jobless Claims Thursday. Number of Americans applying for unemployment benefits last week fell to its lowest level in more than a year. A number of observers are saying it underscores the resilience of the labor market despite elevated interest rates that are intended to cool the economy. Jobless claim app locations fell to 187,000 for the week ending January 13th. That's a decrease of 16,000 from the week before. Those are Labor Department numbers. That's the fewest, by the way, since September 2022. Four-week average of claims fell by a little over 4,700 to 203,250, the lowest four-week average in almost 1 year. Overall, about a little over 1.8 million Americans were collecting jobless benefits during the week that ended January 6th, actually, a decline of 26,000 from the previous week. They've remained at unusually low levels despite higher interest rates and elevated inflation. And though we know inflation continues to ease and has eased fairly significantly over the past year, the Labor Department reported last week that overall prices rose about 0.3% from November and 3.4% from a year ago. It's a sure sign that the Fed's drive to slow inflation to its 2% target will probably remain a bumpy one. We shall see, right? Well, economic activity was little changed in recent weeks as consumer spending over the holiday period met Federal Reserve economists' expectations across most of the U.S. That came even as consumers grow more sensitive to higher prices at a time when the labor market continues to show sign of cooling. All this, according to the Fed's latest beige book released yesterday. There was little or no change in economic activity since the prior beige book period, the Fed said, based on anecdotal information collected by the Fed's 12 reserve banks. Through January 8th. It added that consumers delivered some seasonal relief over the holidays by meeting expectations in most districts, underpinned by increased leisure travel and tourism. Consumers, however, continue to grow wary of higher prices, the report suggests, forcing retailers to narrow their profit margins and to push back in turn on their suppliers' efforts to raise prices, thus perhaps explaining December's low producers' price index, the PPI, increase. The report also said that higher interest rates continue to limit auto sales and real estate deals, but the prospect of falling interest rates was cited by numerous contacts in various sectors as a source of optimism. And with that music, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to take a short break. I sure do hope you'll stick around. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading 1-800-375-4188 or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Talking away. No, I don't know what to say. I'll say it anyway. Today is another day to find you. Shine away. Oh, I'm coming for your love. Okay.
Hey, welcome back to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Dave Allen. Call us at 1-800-375-4188 or check out our website, dgscoins.com. dgscoins.com. While you're there, sign up for our free weekly newsletter and blog. Hey, it's time for our weekly segment, Levity is Golden. Today's topic is Americans' feelings about their finances. We talk regularly on this program about everyday American sentiment about their pocketbooks, their personal finances, and the economy in general. A lot of the surveys show a rather pessimistic view of how things are, particularly when asked in a political context, like those that also ask, who are you planning to vote for? In November, other polls show something different. Well, according to findings from a new Axios Vibe survey conducted by the Harris Poll, Americans overall have a surprising degree of satisfaction with their economic situation. That's in spite of dour views among several subsets of the country, and in contrast to the Michigan and other consumer sentiment polls that remain stubbornly weak, partly, if not largely, because of the lingering effects of high inflation. Now, this particular poll has found that when asked about their financial condition, their own condition, or that of their local community, Americans are more optimistic. It's broadly understood, too, that economic well-being influences electoral outcomes. So with all these mixed results, it's hard to know what to pay attention to. Sometimes I think maybe don't pay attention to any of them. Well, by the same token, political affiliation influences the responses that people who say they're, say, registered Republicans in particular, give when they're asked about the economy. So asking about personal finances rather than the broader economy can reveal optimism not seen in consumer sentiment polls. In any event, here's what the Harris data show about the overall economy. GDP growth is the highest in the developed world. Inflation is headed back down to optimal levels, and consumer spending keeps on growing. Almost two-thirds of Americans, 63%, rate their current financial situation as either good, and that includes 19% of us who say it's very good. Now, neither number is particularly low. They're both in line with the average result. The past 20 times Harris poll has asked this same question. Now, Americans' outlooks for the future are also rosier than the other sentiment surveys. 66% think that 2024 will be better than 2023, and 85% of us feel we could change our personal financial situation for the better this year. That's in line with other Wall Street estimates, which have penciled in continued growth in both GDP and real wages for the rest of the year, although not quite as strong in some cases in 2024 than last year. And 77% of Americans are happy with where they live, including, surprisingly, renters, who've seen their housing costs surge literally over the last few years and are far more likely than homeowners to describe their financial situation as poor. Indeed, a substantial majority of renters are happy renting, they say. 63% of them say they're not interested in owning a home and having a mortgage. The reality is similarly upbeat. Asking rents by landlords, by property owners, finally started falling rather than rising recently. And that, of course, is good news for renters. Meanwhile, most existing mortgages carry very low interest rates, below 4%. Those are existing rates now, not new ones, and that's why we're not seeing a lot of turnover of existing homes. And homes have soared in value. So homeowners are sitting pretty, too. More than half of Americans say if they lost their job tomorrow, they'd be okay. They'd be able to find an equivalent or better job quickly. And that, quote, my employers need me more than I need them, unquote. In fact, 63% of respondents describe their job security as a sure thing. That probably shouldn't be surprising, given that the number of job openings in America is still a lot higher than at any point before the pandemic began. The bottom line, my friends, Americans who believe their community's economy is stronger outnumber those who think it's weak. That is this week's Levity is Golden. Keeping with the same theme, the economy, while the vast majority of economists agree that a soft landing could be ahead, or is likely ahead, as opposed to a hard landing or recession, it wouldn't be wise to rule out a recession, much, you know, or a severe one, for the U.S. economy anyway, just yet. So says Zoe Malfikar in this week's Lombardi letter, adding the chances of it, recession, are still way too high. He writes that many of the arguments for a soft landing are based on the notion that consumer spending is resilient. But he counters that that's not actually the case, and that's increasing the odds of a much worse recession for the U.S. economy. He posits that consumers in the U.S. have started to get frugal, that they've been trying to cut costs wherever they can. He points to a recent Wall Street Journal study showing that almost one quarter of U.S. subscribers to major streaming services like Apple TV, Disney Plus, Netflix, Paramount, etc., have canceled at least three of their subscriptions over the past 2 years. Streaming services are relatively cheap, so they don't necessarily break a person's wallet, but the consumers are getting rid of them. Malfikar believes it could be a sign that they're struggling financially. Well, in my own mind, it could be less that and more they're still concerned about what's going to happen to the economy this coming year, and so they're cutting back on what they perceive as unnecessary expenses. But either way, he says, look at the credit card delinquency rate. In the U.S., it stands at just shy of 3%. But what he says is troubling is that rate's been consistently increasing, and it's now currently the highest it's been since early 2012. Even more troubling, though, it hit a historic low of 1.55% in the third quarter of 2021, and just 2 years later, it's doubled to 11-year highs. Plus, as of last year's third quarter, net savings in the U.S. as a percentage of gross national income were negative 0.7%. Now, the last time net savings were in negative territory was 2020, when a recession, a brief one, the government says, occurred. And before that, 2008, 2009, not so brief of a recession. He points out that since the 1950s, whenever the net savings figure has taken such a nosedive, a recession has almost always followed or had already begun. So even though the stock market isn't priced for a recession, much less a severe one, Zolfikar says that's something that shouldn't be ignored. He points to the S&P 500 trading at a forward 12-month price-to-earnings ratio of 19.5, higher than the 10-year average of 17.6. He concludes that if the odds of a severe recession increase, the U.S. stock market could be in for a rude awakening with investors rushing for the exits. Perspective to keep in mind. Well, we've talked about this recently. A severe drought that began last year has forced authorities to slash more ship crossings. In fact, by 36% in the Panama Canal, one of the world's most important trade routes. Just a quick aside, what's really significant about that is that some of the ships that have been rerouted away from the Red Sea and perhaps around the Horn of Africa use the Panama Canal, particularly if they're doing trade coming from Asia and to the East Coast. Well, these new cuts announced yesterday by authorities in Panama are set to deal an even greater economic blow than even previously expected. Canal Administrator Ricarte Vasquez now estimates that dipping water levels could cost them between, listen to this, $500 and $700 million in this year alone, compared to earlier estimates of just $200 million. One of the most severe droughts to ever hit the Central American nation has stirred chaos, literally, in the 50-mile maritime route. That drought has been causing literal traffic jams of vessels, casting doubts on the canal's reliability for international shipping and raising concerns about its effects on global trade. Vasquez says it's vital that the country sends a message that we're going to take this on and find a solution to this water problem. The disruption of the major trade route between Asia and the U.S. comes at a precarious time indeed. Again, attacks on commercial ships in the Red Sea by the Yemen Houthis rebels have rerouted vessels away from a crucial corridor for consumer goods and energy supplies. And the combination is having far-reaching effects on global trade by delaying shipments and raising transport costs. Thus, it could reinflate prices. Some companies had planned to reroute to the Red Sea, a key route between Asia and Europe, to avoid delays at the Panama Canal, analysts say. Now, that's no longer an option for most of them. Vasquez says that canal authorities would cut daily ship crossings to 24 from 38 a day in normal times last year. Vasquez added that in the first quarter of this year, the passageway is seeing 20% less cargo and almost 800 fewer ships than the same period the year before. Wow. That was a significant reduction for Panama, Vasquez admitted. But he said the more efficient water management and a jump in rainfall in November have at least ensured that water levels are high enough for 24 ships to pass daily until the end of April, which is the start of Panama's next rainy season. Canal authorities warned that it was urgent for Panama to seek new water sources for both the canal and human consumption. The same lake that fills the canal turns out also provide water for more than half of the country of more than 4 million people. Now, as we discussed, oil prices are up today, though they keep trending lower recently, because in spite of escalating Mideast violence, largely, since the Yom Kippur War of 1973, maybe earlier even, in the Arab nation's oil embargo that followed, the region's regular episodes of violence and political volatility have often generated spikes in oil prices. But both U.S. domestic and global benchmark crude oil prices are down more than 10% since Hamas terrorists attacked Israel on October 7th, setting off a new cycle of fighting. For the U.S., the market's response reflects mainly the fact that it's drastically reduced its reliance on oil and petroleum products from OPEC, much of which comes from the political volatile region. It doesn't hurt that U.S. oil production is also up to a historic high. In the late 1970s, about 70% of U.S. imported oil came from OPEC. That's down to about 15%. Progress, ladies and gentlemen. OPEC Plus includes countries that the U.S. has historically had unpleasant relationships with, like Iran and Libya, as well as historical allies such as Saudi Arabia. OPEC has allied, though, with perhaps the U.S.'s top adversary, Russia, whose exports have been petroleum non grata for much of the West since it attacked Ukraine in February 2022. OPEC's loss in the U.S. has been the gain of producers like Canada, Brazil, and Guyana, even, which have increased exports to us, as well as American oil companies, again, which have ratcheted up production to record levels. At the same time, outside the U.S., a drop in global oil prices, with the U.K.'s Brent crude as the main gauge, but largely reflects weakness in demand, they say, as economic struggles in Europe and China have reduced aggregate energy consumption. So look, whether you're talking about Houthi attacks in the Red Sea, the U.S. military responding in Yemen, Iran striking Iraq, Pakistan attacking Iran, and Israel continuing to prosecute its war in Gaza, oil prices look downright docile. Happens in the coming months. And quickly here, before the next break, Republicans and some D's want more arrests, detentions, and deportations to deal with the unprecedented numbers of migrants illegally crossing the southern border, but agencies in charge of that don't have nearly enough cash to do it. Stalled funding deals in Congress are threatening to make an already chaotic situation along the U.S.-Mexico border even worse, as lawmakers demand action but still can't agree on a plan to pay for it, although they say they're getting closer, in the Senate anyway. Border money is tied up in raging political debates. Republicans are calling for the president to do a lot more to secure the border, even as they reject spending requests and policies they say don't go far enough. We'll have more on this story as the funding picture comes clear into view. That music means time for another break. Stick around. We're listening. You're listening. I'm giving talks on financial survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it. Nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interest of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading 1-800-375-4188 or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And well, say it with me one more time today. Welcome back to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Dave Allen. You know where to reach us, 1-800-375-4188. Hey, there's so much talk and enthusiasm around AI at this year's World Economic Forum in Davos that some, like hedge fund Bain Capital guy Steve Pagliuca, joked that its name should be changed to Artificial Intelligence Forum. In fact, the buzz is apparently so thick that some people are sick of talking about it or dismiss its hype as overly dramatic. Pagliuca buys into the incredible promise of AI, but he also offered a warning. A lot of these companies aren't going to make it. He said there will be a burst of people, of course, who invested in every single thing that had the word AI in front of it. And I guess Pagliuca has the perspective to make that call with more than 30 years as a tech investor in his various roles. He said it reminds me of 1999, and it was hard to tell if he was kidding when he talked about being pressed to sign term sheets within 2 hours to plow money into internet startups claiming 100 million valuations but no revenue. He claims that he turned many of those down, although he recently made an investment in Liquid AI, a startup company formed by MIT researchers. He had a couple of important business takeaways from this. One is that a potential killer app for AI would be improved search, threatening the dominance of Google and Microsoft. That's why he says they're plowing billions into the field. The other, he believes, is that future AI uses for narrow purposes, say healthcare would be far less costly than the everything AI models like ChatGPT because, well, a hospital AI system wouldn't need to be trained in Mozart's music. We're still in the experimental phase, Pagliuca said. I think it will be just as revolutionary, though, as the internet was. Nobel laureate Michael Spence weighed the pitfalls associated with AI, like job losses, election monkey wrenching, tough to detect fakery, and came up with a simple conclusion. AI is a winner. Spence said, quote, deployed widely, it has the potential to produce a tremendous productivity surge. By the end of the decade, we could be on a completely different sustainable growth trajectory, unquote. Well, he isn't minimizing the concerns over AI, though. But his takeaway was don't let the hand-wringing get in the way of seizing a tremendous opportunity. Just put some guardrails in place and embrace it. Well, let's put them in place first before we move too far ahead. He said, I don't want to be Pollyannish about it, but I just think it would be a terrible shame in a world that has labor shortages, fragmenting supply chains, and a lot of supply-side constraints to throw away the most powerful tool we have for producing a productivity surge and growth. Hold on to your jobs, ladies and gentlemen. It sure looks more and more like the 21st century is going to be a bumpy, bumpy ride. Well, in today's first segment, we talked about this week's airstrikes between Iran and Pakistan that killed at least 11 people. That uptick in violence marks a significant escalation in the troubled relations between those neighbors. Long-running, low-level insurgencies on either side of the border have frustrated both countries. And the apparent targets of the strike, Iran's on Tuesday and Pakistan's today, were apparently insurgent groups whose goal is an independent nation for ethnic Baluch areas in Iran, Pakistan, and Afghanistan. Do I hear Baluchistan, anybody? The question is why Iran and Pakistan would choose to strike insurgents in each other's territory rather than their own, considering the risk of a wider conflict. Iran and Pakistan share a 560-mile largely lawless border where smugglers and militants are said to roam freely. Both countries have suspected each other of supporting or at least behaving leniently towards some of those groups operating on the other side of the border. I don't know how you pronounce this, Jaish al-Adal, a Sunni separatist group that Iran targeted on Tuesday, is believed to operate out of Pakistan, launching attacks on Iranian security forces. The Baluch Liberation Army, formed in 2000, has launched attacks against Pakistani security forces and Chinese infrastructure projects. So they're suspected of hiding out in Iran. Well, for its part, Pakistan said its strikes in Iran today were aimed at hideouts of the Baluchistan Liberation Army and the Baluchistan Liberation Front. It also wanted to send a message to Iran and other neighbors that it can fight back if provoked. The last time Pakistan retaliated against a neighboring country, you may recall, was in 2019 when it downed two Indian warplanes and captured a pilot in the disputed Kashmir region. That followed an Indian strike inside Pakistan against what New Delhi said was a terrorist training camp. Iran and Pakistan have long had a volatile relationship, but experts say these strikes are likely being prompted by internal dynamics. Tehran has been experiencing a growing pressure for some kind of action after a deadly Islamic State group attack earlier this month. Israel's war on Iran's ally, Hamas, and wider unrest against its theocracy. Pakistan's attack also served a domestic purpose. According to Abdullah Khan from the Pakistan Institute for Conflict and Security Studies, the government and military have been under immense pressure since Tuesday. Public perception of a strong army is not as it used to be, so it had to respond. Well, Iran's military today began a planned annual air defense drill stretching from its port of Chabahar near Pakistan in the east all the way across the country to its border with Iraq in the west. The drill will reportedly include live fire from aircraft, drones, and air defense systems. Fresh strikes by Iran and Pakistan can't be ruled out either, although this week's attacks raise questions about the preparedness of their own militaries, particularly their radar and air defense systems. For Pakistan, such systems are crucial, given its constant low-level tensions with its nuclear-armed rival India. Its equipment has long been deployed along that frontier rather than its border with Iran. Separately, Iran relies on radar and air defense systems in the case of potential strikes by its main enemy, the United States. Launching these strikes allowed Tehran to point to it directly, taking military action without risking a wider confrontation with either Israel or the U.S., particularly as tensions also remain high over Iran's rapidly advancing nuclear program. However, the airstrikes could backfire on Pakistan because the Baloch Liberation Army said it will avenge the killings and wage war on the state. Thus, America's feared escalation of broader Middle East tensions appears well founded. Hey, here, Pam and Russ Martins in today's Wall Street on Parade write about Annette Admatis and German economist Martin Helwig's newly released, updated, and expanded book called The Banker's New Clothes: What's Wrong with Banking and What to Do About It. One issue that Admatis and Helwig write about is the much-needed sunshine on the accounting gimmickry that allows U.S. banks, particularly the too big to fails, to hide billions of dollars in losses on bonds by simply labeling them held to maturity securities. Ellie and I talked about that a couple of weeks ago. They assert accounting rules should be changed so that banks must apply fair value accounting to all assets, regardless of how long they intend to hold them. The Martins say that Admatis and Helwig also provide brilliant new insights into the bank failures that occurred last spring. Those failures, which amount to the second, third, and fourth largest in U.S. history, resulted in the Fed creating yet another new bailout program, the Bank Term Funding Program. That, despite the American people being reassured since 2010 that the Dodd-Frank financial reform legislation ended too big to fail. Yeah, right. Well, look, pick up your copy of The Banker's New Clothes at your local bookstore or library. The book's not cheap, but it sure looks to be an important eye-opener. Excuse me. As Kitco News reported this morning, Wilhelm Mittelkoop, founder of the Commodity Discovery Fund, says that the growing importance of gold in the world's monetary framework represents a profound shift in global finance. The main driver is the diminishing trust in the U.S. dollar following the freezing of Russian foreign exchange reserves after its Ukrainian invasion, essentially compelling central banks to increase their gold reserves. He points out the spike in interest rates, which led to substantial losses for bondholders like commercial banks, asset managers, and yes, central banks themselves. He writes, this erosion of value in government bonds, typically a cornerstone of central bank reserves, has forced, well, European central banks to consider using their gold revaluation accounts to offset balance sheet losses. That, he adds, could avoid the need for government bailouts that could undermine central bank autonomy. Interesting. However, he continues, this recourse to gold, dormant in reserves for decades, bears consequential implications. Quote, it could undermine confidence in national currencies, potentially triggering a shift from fiduciary currencies to gold, among especially emerging market central banks. At the same time, central banks are struggling with unprecedented losses on their bond holdings, which they largely accumulated during the quantitative easing period following the 2008 Great Recession, and like the Fed during the pandemic. Middlekoop explains this period of market support led to substantial asset accumulation, which through measures like quantitative tightening has dwindled, resulting losses on bond holdings totaling hundreds of billions of dollars have strained banks' balance sheets, leading to collapses and market turmoil. Well, Middlekoop points out that the gold accumulation trend by central banks is gaining momentum, primarily driven by nations east of Germany, like Poland, the Czech Republic, and Hungary, as a response to perceived currency debasement resulting from QE. China and Russia, he observes, notably reduced their U.S. Treasury holdings, emphasizing gold as a safer reserve asset amidst Western sanctions. The shift towards gold has also been observed, he says, in emerging economies like Brazil, India, and South Africa. Middlekoop also said that as so many central banks in both the developing and developed world accumulate gold and prepare themselves to at least be in a position to revalue their gold holdings, the question becomes whether the Fed, the world's number one gold holder and issuer of the world's dominant reserve currency, the dollar, might also consider revaluation. I think that's a long shot, particularly in the short term. But, I mean, hey, who knows? There's been a decent amount of turnover the last couple of years. If this is under consideration, it sure isn't showing up in any meeting minutes. Middlekoop concludes, such a move would mark another pivotal stride in gold's reemergence onto the monetary stage. Yet another credible perspective that suggests why beefing up your nest egg with plenty of gold and silver, I mean physical gold and silver, is so important. It's an insurance policy that protects you and your family. Don't delay. This could be another banner year, likely will be another banner year, with interest rates beginning to come down for gold and silver. Don't miss out before those prices start to take off to another level. Call us at 1-800-375-4188. Hey, that's all the time we have for today's program. I'll be back next Tuesday. Melody will be back tomorrow with Butch to close out another week. Also, be on the lookout for our weekly What a Rush of Gold and Silver blog in your email inboxes in the morning. Thanks, as always, to our production engineer, Todd Waite, and to you for tuning into Financial Survival. I'm Dave Allen. Please be safe out there. Have a good evening. Bye-bye. Seems to be a single penny left for me. That's too bad. In my dreams, I have a plan. If I got you.